Hi and welcome to Matrix Moments. This is Saloni and on today's episode, we have Nitin Kamat, the founder and CEO of Zerodha, India's largest tech broking discount firm, as well as Vikram Vaidyanathan, Managing Director at Matrix Partners India. This is Nitin's second podcast with us and in an unplugged and completely candid conversation with Vikram, they cover Zerodha's recent growth and success, why they continue to be a bootstrapped company and have stayed away from external funding, the burgeoning IPO landscape in India, as well as Rain Matter Foundation, Zerodha's not-for-profit that's focused on climate change. They cover all of this and more. Tune in.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of our Matrix podcast. My guest needs no introduction. He's a very familiar face for most of you. But welcome, Nitin Kamat, the co-founder of Zerodha, bootstrapped and celebrated by everyone, and is the largest platform across all brokerages. Nitin, thanks for doing it. And Nitin and I, disclaimers first, Nitin and I are friends, know each other for a while. We are co-investors in multiple companies. He's also involved with a couple of nonprofits that I'm involved in. So we have lots of different connects. And to be clear, I called Nitin about the most famous board minutes in a while. And I was irritated by the response that he was getting online, as well as the fact that he had to justify with his own response. So I was irritated about everything. So I called him. And that's why we're doing this podcast. So Nathan, thank you for doing this.
Hey, thanks. Thanks, Vikram, for having me.
So let's get into it. I think this was probably the most famous board minutes, like I said, in a while, where you guys got approval to potentially pay yourself 100 crores. And let me just state a position on where I am, right? You guys are bootstrapped, which means that you made no contract with other shareholders and investors like myself to unlock value through equity. And now you've created a lot of value through profits by serving your customers as well as your employees really well, which you I know is very close to your heart. And you've done all of that, but now there is value in profits. The question is, how do you unlock that value? And you unlock that value through salary, which I think is completely your prerogative. And that's the way a lot of people have done it. I just think that this conversation itself is unnecessary. But since it's out there, we should talk about it. At least where I am is, this is your prerogative. But I'm surprised you chose the most tax inefficient way to extract value. Right. Through salary. So talk me through some of the choices.
Firstly, I didn't know that people are tracking, you know, these things. We'll be more careful going forward because, firstly, it was, it's a threshold. I mean, there's not like something that we are taking out. So it's just that, so we don't really have fixed needs of liquidity, as in, I think we've all kind of, at a point where, all our needs are taken care of. So usually we take liquidity out when there is opportunities to invest in something outside the business, be it for profit, be it for non-profit. So salary that way is a decent choice because you have the flexibility to take it out as and when required, right? I mean, you can potentially do buyback. A buyback is, in terms of taxation, is maybe, like a percentage point lesser than salary. But with buyback, you can't just do buyback as and when. It's not a very optimal way to do it. You can set up structures, which a lot of promoters do, right? As in especially in companies where you don't have external investors, you can easily create 3 or 4 partnerships, which bill consultancy fees to the main company, and yeah, companies who do it, and you can take it out paying much lesser taxes than what we end up potentially paying, because we end up for any salary that we take, we end up paying 43-44%. So almost half of it goes away as taxes, right? And so even if you want to do good with the money, as in if you want to give it to a nonprofit, you're actually, for every 100 bucks, you're just getting 54 bucks to give away. So, but as an ideology, as in everyone within the business, we have always thought about taxes as a way of giving back, as in, so we have never, if you look at us, look at our financials, right? From first year of the business, we are always the first to file income tax. There is nothing done, a lot of businesses wait till the last day due date to file and et cetera, right? As in, because they're spending a lot of time tax planning and et cetera. So we've done none of that jazz. As in, we've always, like, are one of the first companies to file taxes. I mean, it's so funny that, you know, like, I think for the last 2-3 years, we've been one of the highest paying income tax guys in you know, around award. I mean, there are people I know who wear a Richard Mille who pay, you know, like 3 lakh, 4 lakh rupees in taxes. And I'm like, dude, what the hell? What's, you know, what's going on? So, no, but I also understand why there was, you know, probably angst wherever it was. Because I think, you know, in a world where we are in India, where there are so many people below poverty line, this whole thing, you know, it almost sounds very ugly, as in, you know, as in this whole concentration of wealth and someone being able to take so much wealth out, you know, in terms of salaries, you know, it's a little ugly in the way it sounds. And if I knew that there'll be so much coverage on this, you know, if I could have even anticipated even to this policy, and we wouldn't have done it.
Yeah. So I know, you know, we all have different views which are more capitalist, but I truly don't think you should be apologetic at all about it. I think you've always done things differently, and being bootstrapped, not taking any money from everyone, and the way you built the company. And here again, you're making a choice which is different from everyone else, which is to take it in salary. You could have just made the same money by selling a small portion in your company. It would have been more efficient, and I think people would have just said, yeah, that, you know, this company. I just think that I don't think you should be apologetic about it around some of this. Let's talk a little bit about just unlocking value. And you and I have had different conversations for a long time as investors, and maybe I was the first one to come calling to invest in, and now just buy portions of the company. You don't need external money. You've made a big choice not to take external investors because you think that it affects the way you would serve your employees and your customers. First, talk a little bit about that. And second, you know, does this incident make you rethink some of it?
Right. Yeah. No, I mean, see, the thing is, I, in my previous avatar, used to manage people's money. And so when I used to be a sub-broker, I used to manage people's portfolios, and I hated the obligation money brought on the table. Right? So I think the whole genesis of not taking people's money starts there. As in, so firstly, I don't like that obligation because I know that once I take, you know, once if Zerodha were to take someone's money, now we are obligated to get their money to grow fast, right? As in, you have to give return on the capital invested. And I know that in our business, like, you know, I've said this before, which is what is right for the investor is hardly ever right for the customer, right? And what sets us apart as a business is that we've never done something that is not right for the customer, right? I mean, we could have easily built our lending business by now. We could have easily built a margin funding business by now. We could, you know, we could send tips, stock tips, you know, or research reports to trigger people to do more trades. Or you could, you know, like how some of the large brokers in the US do, right? Every time you trade, you know, have those confetti, you know, just create all those things which can get people to trade more or, you know, generate more revenue for the business. And, but we know that that's not good for the customer. And so there are two reasons why we made this choice. One is, firstly, I mean, to begin with, thanks to Kay and our tech team, you know, we know that we have some distance on the product, right? Because you know, these guys are special, and they built a product that helps us stay ahead of the competition, right? Because if the products were commoditized, you know, if all our competition was offering, you know, something which is extremely similar, then, you know, the usually the ones who will spend more will, you know, who have deeper pockets will win that fight, right? So for us, you know, it starts there, right? Saying that as long as the product has some distance, we know that we don't really need the money. And to build a good product, you don't really need money, right? I mean, you really need money to go acquire customers, right? And you know that if your product can be ahead of your competition, if you're doing what is right for the customer, right? And that is very tough to do if you have investors on board, right? And I mean, all of these things together.
My answer to that has always been, you have to get the right investors. You might not have it. But I understand where you're coming from. But, you know, food for thought is that this is probably a better way to unlock more value long term for your employees and so on. And potentially also, you know, put a higher bar on governance and so on for your customers. But I know you've thought about all of that. So I'm going to leave it at that. But suffice to say, if you ever decide to change your mind, there's already a long list of investors outside your door. And I think there'll be an even longer list if you
See, the thing is, like you said, right? I mean, if there was need of money, if money could help a business grow faster, we would have raised money, right?
Yeah. No, I understand.
So like you said, right? Will this incident somehow make us change our mind on this? Absolutely not. I mean, there's a lot of blood and sweat that's gone behind this. So I don't think.
I know you've thought this through, and I admire the courage of conviction on sticking with your thought process. The one thing I want to clarify is just salaries for founders, because we are on multiple investments and so on. And we'll share a link to the podcast from my partner, Vish, where he's actually benchmarked salaries for founders at different stages and so on. And I think the difference between a venture capital funded company is that there is an explicit contract between us as investors, as well as founders, that we are going to unlock value through our equity together. Right? And a lot of our founders have made as much or more money than is being talked about right now through equity. Right? So, but because you've actually said that we're going to partner together and we're going to unlock value through equity, you often find that salaries are not as big in venture capital funded companies. And that's the way that equation and that world works. So I just wanted to clarify that. Moving to another topic and related, which is the IPOs that are coming. And it's obviously a big moment for the startup ecosystem because it completes the cycle of companies getting founded by founders, getting investors on board, but now really becoming institutions that are going public. So a couple of questions for you, or maybe it's what advice you have for companies that are going public. First, on sizing.
Right.
And some of these IPOs are going to be amongst the largest IPOs ever in India.
Right. Right.
It's not in the tech space.
Right.
So it's a new type of company, which is a tech-enabled company in some ways, or a tech-first company. And you're suddenly going to a retail investor in India with the largest IPO.
Right.
How do you see that sort of working out, and what advice would you have on sizing?
I mean, if you actually look at some of these recent IPOs, right, the retail portion of it hasn't really been the most significant, right? As in the retail has really been maybe 10-15% of the entire IPO, right? As in most of the money has come from larger institutionals and HNI kind of crowd. HNI were in it to maybe make a pop on listing. But then it eventually retail ends up holding it because usually these IPOs are marketed well. So even if the allotment doesn't really happen in the IPO, people end up buying it in the secondary market after listing. Now, about the sizing, the thing is, I personally don't know why stock markets are there where they are at right now. Right? In terms of, we are at all-time highs and there seems to be like a dichotomy. So, but one of the reasons for that is that there's a liquidity rush, so there is a lot of liquidity out there, as in right from retail investors to, you know, institutionals that you already know about. So I'm guessing, you know, if these folks are coming with such large IPOs, they have done the math, you know, in the sense they know that there is demand for, if marketed well, there is demand. But the only problem though is that, like, which I have with, I mean, this is really good for our business, right? I mean, we get to now go sell, I mean, in the sense, millennials in India will get to invest into products that consume, right? Which has not happened historically in India. So, I mean, our whole bet here is that if these companies come and list, the markets will expand, right? Like the way in the US, right? I mean, the FANGs have just expanded the market significantly. So that is exciting. But what is not is that, you know, a lot of folks look at IPOs as an exit. Right. Almost. Right. I mean, every investor, every term sheet has this whole, you know, whatever, 7-year IPO exit and clauses. Right. As in, so, you know, it's almost celebrated as, you know, we've arrived in life. Right. But really for a founder, I think it's a beginning and not really the end. Right. As in, because you're now obligated to the most people who can't really take risk. Right. Because all your venture capitalists and private equity guys, I mean, all of us are high risk kind of guys. Right. I mean, we can afford to take risks. So I think the problem with IPOs today is that they're juiced out, right? As in, by the time there is...
Yeah. So let's double click on that. And question is on IPOs pricing. So we address some sizing questions.
Yeah.
How much money would you leave on the table? And we were doing some analysis on mid-market IPOs. And the jury's quite out there. And I was surprised. I expected to see all mid-market IPOs trading way above their listing.
Right.
I was surprised that most were trading way below their listing. Even companies that I actually hold in my portfolio, which have done well for me, but they're actually below where they listed.
Right.
So how should startup founders think about pricing?
No, I mean, see, the thing is, I think in India, right, the public market investors, I don't think still understand value growth. You know, I mean, I think, you know, Indian public market investors are still looking at price to earnings and stuff like that, right? So it's very tough for Indian markets, I think, to have whatever IPOs who don't yet have profits and who are valued based on growth to get, the similar kind of valuation in the private market they get in the public market, right? So I think founders have to be cognizant of that and not price their IPOs to perfection, right? As in, because today when IPOs come out, it's almost priced to perfection and that's a problem, right? As in, and if you don't end up growing as fast as you can, you will end up losing money. And the problem with IPOs is that if you have three or four large IPOs that don't do well or they go below the issue price, we have opportunity of this large retail investor market in India who can potentially move away from assets which don't contribute back to the economy like gold or fixed deposits to actually backing entrepreneurs. Right. But if you lose money for them, you know, you're going to lose that whole category of customers. And I think in India, for India long-term to grow into a super economic kind of a power, you need Indians, right? As in to put money behind Indian entrepreneurs, right? Because today, I mean, all the value is really getting created, for people sitting outside India, right?
Yeah.
And I think, Indian founders should be cognizant. I mean, I think, Like how I feel obligated, to our customer. I think, every founder should be obligated to a retail investor as well. So I think you need to leave as much value as possible at IPO. And I think there was this whole Narayan Murthy's conversation around this, right? As in about how to make money. You need to make sure that, you can make enough money for investors, retail investors.
No, that's well said. And, I'm just going to recap. One on sizing, you're not as worried. Just because of the liquidity that you see in the market and the fact that institutional investors, I agree with you, have been looking to invest in these companies for a while and they haven't had an opportunity to invest in these companies. So I think there's enough institutional interest which should actually take care of the IPO sizing. I think it's a great point around pricing and especially of the early IPOs that they need to be successful. And we need to have this cycle of Indian investors backing Indian entrepreneurs. I thought that statement was very well said. And I think both of us are wishing luck to all of our friends who are going public. And I'm hoping all of these IPOs go well.
Yep. And I think at least the last few IPOs, we were the biggest, retail portion of the IPOs. So I'm super excited, for some of these new companies about to list now. So.
Switching gears on what's happening at Zerodha. And I know you've, I think you shut down one of your offices and starting to really embrace remote work and distributed workforce. Talk a little bit about some of those choices and I'll talk about some of my concerns.
Right. Yeah. So we've been, doing polls internally asking people, about what they feel about work from home and et cetera. So we are an 1,100 member team, right? And out of which, I doubt if the 100 core member team, which includes tech and some of the core operations or processes, I doubt if they can really work from home permanently, right? I mean but the rest of the 900, which is our sales, our support, our account opening, I mean all of these teams can potentially work from home, right? And we've announced already, so we've already asked everyone to say that whoever wants to work from home permanently, just plan your moves. There are one of the triggers for this was also that now that, you know, with rain matter climate, we're giving back, right? And I mean, the more you kind of look at it, the more you realize, I think the big problem for India is the fact that our cities are choking, right? I think we need to get, you need to somehow have these economies of smaller towns and cities revive, right? As in, and businesses like us, if we have an opportunity to somehow enable that, I think we should do it. And we've said these 900 plus people can completely permanently work from home. We have within the business, built a bunch of these tools to share knowledge and interact and all of that. I mean, it seems to be working well. The other thing, what has happened for us with this whole work from home now as a strategy is that for us, for the support team, where we need folks with background of stock markets, et cetera, and access to that kind of talent in Bangalore is tougher, right? For example, today we can hire people from Jaipur, from Ahmedabad, from Calcutta, where folks who understand what is futures and options, who understand what is, because in Bangalore, our strategy with our support team was to hire people, freshers, and then try to train them on the markets. And we used to spend a lot of time and effort for that. And there was very, it was very tough to access that kind of talent in Bangalore. Now with this whole remote work from...
So let me pause you there. And I remember from our last conversation, which was a public podcast, I remember you telling me the story of that every single person who joins Zerodha has to start at customer service, right? Because you want them to be connected to that customer, but also learn how Zerodha treats their customer. How do you do that with this distributed workforce where, everybody sitting at their home? How do they learn from others? How do they learn what is the Zerodha way?
Right. Yeah. So like I said, so we have an instance of discourse for this whole knowledge sharing thing that it's become really, really active over the last 1 year. So I spend a lot of my time and, Kailash and, et cetera. So also, which is constantly, kind of putting it out there that what we stand for a business. Right? The other thing is that we don't hire too much, right? I think this whole work from home strategy works okay, as long as you're not always in this rush to hire people, right? We don't have to hire too much because we don't have too many people leaving us, right? Our tech team, like Kailash keeps saying, if you hire three people, it's too many people for the year, and we haven't had anyone leave our tech team as such, I mean, maybe one or two have left in the last 5-6 years, right? So I don't think this whole work from home strategy works well if you're constantly in a rush to hire people. Right? Just to give an example, we were at almost 1100 member team when we were at 1.5-2 million customers. We are at 6 million customer. We're still 1100 member team, right? So our hiring is really not too aggressive. And that's why I think this whole strategy of working from home is okay. And when we hire, we're hiring very slow, right? As in you hire 5 people, 10 people and get them to spend a lot of time with the, kind of existing bunch of people. And, I can't imagine how we could hire 100 people, for example, and that culture kind of pass through, right? I think that is very tough.
I'm picking up a few learnings for founders who are managing these distributed workforces. One is invest a lot in onboarding and making sure there is some osmosis at that time of onboarding where people are imbibing the culture. Second, spending a lot of time as founders and top team groups in making sure that people who are coming in, new people who are coming in, are really learning your culture. And especially with a company like Zerodha, it's a very established culture. And third, and this might work in a slower growth environment. And on that, when you are hiring, aggressively and call it hundreds of people in a year, do you still see some of this working? Because that's where some of the early startups are struggling.
Yeah. No, I think that's very tough. I doubt, if you're a 50 member team and you're planning to go to 200 member team.
Yeah.
I doubt that can really happen. Right. I mean, the thing is, like I said, right. I mean, I think these things for us have worked out well as a thing is because we hardly have any attrition amongst, our team. So that's really the key, right? As in, if there are founders trying to, instead of hiring more people, try to retain more people, right? As in, so once you can do it, then it's easier to...
No, I think you have a fantastic virtuous cycle going on culture, low attrition, and then being able to get great operating leverage. And I think this is sort of taking your operating leverage to a different level where you're getting more out of your existing employees while potentially doing good, which I know.
And the value creation is also so much more, right? Like, for example, like, you know, 1100 member team holding stock of Zerodha is very different to a 10,000 member team holding stock of Zerodha, right? As in, so, right? So the value creation for everyone working in the business.
Our employees. And that's a great insight into how you think about value creation for each employee. So Nitin, switching from value creation to how you're sort of distributing value, talk a little bit about Rainmatter Foundation, and I know you're involved with one of the nonprofit that I'm on the board of. And you've committed a lot, not just to our nonprofit, but also to multiple nonprofits. Why is that important to you?
So firstly, I think this whole thing got enabled because of Kailash. So I need to give credit to him because he is our, you know, like the conscience check of sorts, saying, you know, I mean, but we've all kind of agreed. See, the thing is, I never thought our business would get to this size, right? As in, I'd be joking if I, you know, ever thought we will ever be at this much profits as a business. But, you know, the more, you know, as we've done well, we've realized that there is a problem on this planet, which is concentration of wealth. And I don't see how that, you know, in the current capitalistic kind of environment, I don't see how that's going to change. I think the rich will continue getting richer, and unless the rich, I mean, unless that person's kind of figuring a way to give back to the, you know, to the society, I think it's a problem for this planet, right? And So, I mean, this whole giving back is triggered from that, is that, you know, we have almost like, a, you know, with great power, whatever comes great responsibility types, right? As in, right. And amongst the various causes, you know, that we could have picked, I think what we were most passionate about were two things. One, I mean, I think we all know that climate change is probably the biggest problem of this planet. There is no vaccine that's going to fix it. I think by the time, you know, it's causes havoc, I think it'll be irreversible. I think we're probably beyond that point already, right? And but the other problem in India, what we realize is also around this creation of livelihoods. I think this whole, you know, we need to find ways to create employment. And for us, in our head, we thought the answer to both probably lie in each other, right? And so that's really all, you know, the causes that we are supporting is what can potentially create green jobs, which is, you know, jobs away from large cities, and also in some way help in climate change, right? So we are, I mean, this is a new field, is outside our core competency. Samir has joined to head this for us, and it's been a learning, you know. I mean, we've been meeting to so many interesting nonprofits and profit, you know, working on these causes. And we have in our head, whatever is more than what we require is going to be given back over a period of time, as and when we come across opportunities, right? And the reason we got Samir and the team to come and do this for us is that what we realize is that giving back is actually a lot more tougher than making it, right? Because, you know, making it requires a different kind of skill set versus giving back, right? And because you can't really see, you know, your impact of giving back, you know, like you, and when you're making it, you know that you put this much effort, you get to see this much, right? Giving back, those things take a lot of time, right? As in, you need.
I agree with you. I think allocating your capital for impact, and especially nonprofit impact, I think is the hardest thing. But I really appreciate the fact that you put a structure around it and are really thinking, you know, 10, 50 years ahead to figure out. And I think I have the patience to say this will take 10 years.
Right.
And like with everything that you do, you've chosen the harder problem, which is environment and climate change, where very few people are working. And then you've also taken a long-term view to it. So that's inspiring. Now I'm going to just tackle a couple of topics on the startup ecosystem side. And this is more you helping me figure out where to make investments. So there's this entire new wave of wealth techs in social investing. And it's essentially, hey, I know a bunch of great investors in my community, and potentially I can discover new investors, and let me just go copy their strategy in some way, right? And in another way, it's also that you're creating a group of more educated, more sophisticated investors. So this sounds really good. What's wrong with that idea?
No, I mean, we've tried it. There was this company called eToro, which was doing this. It's still large. But I think in 2016, we had built a very similar platform. And we killed it very soon. And the reasons for doing it was firstly, people... So the thing is this whole following the leader, right? Who is the leader is a question, right? As in, of course, on social media, et cetera, you will find a lot of people claiming to be profitable, et cetera. But I can tell you that a lot of them aren't, right? I mean, a lot of these guys are just faking it, right? As in, and also in stock markets, right? Knowing more doesn't really mean that you can earn more. It doesn't work like that. I could know everything about stock markets and everything about economy. And I could, my son who has no knowledge could potentially be doing better than me in terms of returns on money, So if he had to go pick up a bunch of stocks and invest in, right. So I think firstly, the problem here is it's very tough to get people who can perform, right? In a platform like this, you need, you need those star traders whom, others can follow. Right. And as soon as you put his performance out there, the second problem is that fellow feels conscious about it. Right. Now, even if he was performing well before, now that he knows that there are 100 people following him, there is almost a pressure. Right? And, 99 out of 100 people kind of fail in pressure. Right. As in, it's only a few people. I mean, a lot of people can do well when they know that no one's watching them. But as soon as you put them on a stage, you know that they're going to choke. Right. As in, and that's the second problem with this platform. Yeah. And the third problem is it's not good for that person who becomes a leader, is because what we have seen with our experience is that fellow starts taking aggressive bets to cover up for there's a small crowd down, he needs to, right? So that whole finding a leader is firstly problem. Second is regulation wise. This guy sharing his trading ideas, does he have to be a registered investment advisor or not is a question.
Let's not even get onto the regulation. That's a
So that the stance people are taking is it's not required. But if you actually look at it, if that person who's a leader is making money in any form, you will have to end up becoming an RIA or RA, right? So which then means that you can't really scale that very well.
I think you're taking a more systemic view, and my view is much more. Can we get, we've got a whole bunch of savers who become investors over the last 18 months. And I find ideas being very, very rudimentary and they're a little bit lost. Right. And this seems like a great way to get them to a next level of sophistication. But I agree with you. In every community, you need the nodes and super nodes around which this will be created. And the supply of content here is actually limited because you can't find these.
The thing is, and spoon feeding doesn't help people, right? The day the spoon stops feeding, the person is.
So you're not really created an investor, is your point.
Of course, if that guy is educating people, then there is probably, an opportunity, right? Yeah. But if I'm following you and you're going to keep doing a bunch of trades, I'm going to look at it and do it. You are essentially spoon feeding me, It's really helping me in any way of sorts.
Sure. Last topic on alternate assets, and there is this entire set of NCDs, potentially gold, potentially property shares, all of which is now actively getting discussed and getting traded. And there is a set of emerging HNIs and even very maybe smaller AUM investors who all want that part in their portfolio. A, how are you looking at it? And B, what would be your advice to founders who are starting up in those alternative asset spaces?
I think equity is not the right product. I can say it because there's no obligation, but I think equity is not really the right product for majority of Indians, right? Because equity is volatile. And if you introduce, the risk of equity to a lot of first-time investors and they see a drawdown, they're going to become inactive. So personally, I've always thought that some form of debt, which is a little less risky than equity, but higher returns than a bank deposit, is a right stepping stone because personally, I'm sold to the idea. I'm sold to the idea that as long as you can securitize that asset, in some form, and reduce the risk and somehow give like a 200, 300 basis points higher than and a fixed deposit kind of a return is probably a good product to go out.
But it needs like this big underlying securitization exchange and ecosystem, right?
Absolutely.
Who's going to create it?
I mean, that's really where the opportunity is, you know, so, so you have to kind of manufacture products. I don't think there's something to distribute right now, right? If there was something to distribute, we would have done it already, right? As in, I think the real opportunity is to go and manufacture something like that, you know, actually go and build that whole ecosystem of sorts to securitize assets. And then for distribution, I think there are enough and more platforms like us. If you manufacture decent products, I think also the other problem today there is that it's regulatorily, it's not like dark gray, it's very light gray.
Yeah.
Because no one has done it yet, right? As in, no one has sold it to retail investors. I mean, these are all, you know, kind of everyone's working in light gray areas, as in this property, this thing, and NCDs, and all of the way the transaction's working. So I think what also needs here is that one of them to become large enough for regulation to come and say, you know what, this is how, you're regulated now. Because once that happens, then distribution will jump in and start distributing those products.
No, I've been excited about this idea of a securitization infrastructure ecosystem for a while. And especially since FinTech started, one of the things that's been a big source of friction for FinTechs is going and actually talking to the same banks. And then the FinTechs change their entire business model so that they can conform to what the banks think. Their debt should be used for. Whereas this kind of securitization exchange is what is needed for this entire fintech lending ecosystem to explode. And that's what made it possible in US, Europe, and especially China. Right? Yes. So I'm hoping that you or someone else actually creates it, because that will be a big enabler for the fintech ecosystem.
Right, absolutely.
So Nitin, you and I can keep talking for hours. And I remember starting this prep with saying that this will be 20 minutes. and I was clearly wrong, because it just turns out that when you and I start talking, it just keeps going. I know you're busy today, and thank you for taking the time. I think the thing that strikes me the most every time I talk to you is how humble and thoughtful you are. And the courage of conviction that you have after having thought through what your different options are is frankly inspiring. I might disagree with you, and I do disagree with you on many things. But the fact that you thought about this, and you thought about the downside of not going with another choice, and then the courage of conviction to say, I'm going to live with that choice, and then I'm going to stick by it, frankly, is just always inspiring. And of course, the amount that you're doing in terms of giving back, I think should be an inspiration to everybody who's sort of creating wealth. And then it's almost their duty to sort of distribute wealth. Thank you for spending the time, man.
Thanks, Vikram. Thanks for having me on this.
Thanks for tuning in. For more Matrix Moments episodes, you can head to www.matrixpartners.in/blog. You can also follow us on Twitter, LinkedIn, and YouTube for more updates.